If you do this, your problem as a business owner is going to be that you got to be a person that loves to adapt and loves to become a different person, because every other week almost, or every other month at the longest sometimes, you're literally completely...
Are you an agency owner or a high-ticket consultant or coach? Well, let me guess. You're currently stuck in a sales plateau, aren't you? Or maybe you're looking to scale from 6 to 7 figures. Am I right? Well, today JR sits down with none other than Mike Mark. That's right, I said it. Mike Mark. Don't be fooled by his two first names. Apart from having 128 mutual friends on Facebook and a mutual love of Hawaiian shirts, Mike Mark knows his shit when it comes to scaling to 6 and 7 figures while improving the quality of your life. Sounds like he knows a thing or two about instant leverage, if you ask me. Welcome to the Instant Leverage Podcast.
All right, so we're here with Mike Mark, CEO of CoachingSales.com. First of all, thank you so much for being here, because you are one of the main people that inspired the name of my brand and this podcast.
I appreciate it, dude. It's been awesome to see you take it and run with it. So,
yeah, so for those of you that don't know what we're talking about, Mike Mark had an event that I went to, and we were coming up with like two words to describe our offer, our business. And I had a list of like, it's just a bunch of like nonsense. And then you kind of came over and you looked at it and you're like, nah, I don't really like any of those. And then you're like, but like, what do you say to people? And we're like, well, it's like instant leverage. And you're like, ooh, I like that. And then I checked the domain, and the domain was available, but it was listed as a premium domain on GoDaddy. And then I was like, all right, fuck it. This is going to be my commitment to this whole rebrand and like moving everything from out from not being under my name. So we got the domain. Now we got the podcast, and this is like, sounds like it was like a long period of time, but this is like a month ago, when you had this event.
So yeah, it was March, what was it? 4th, 5th and 6th. So here we are about a month and a half later.
Yeah. So, tell us a little bit about who you are, what you do, and then we'll dive into it.
Yeah, pretty much, what I've become is the person that if you are taking a bunch of sales calls and say you're at like 30, 50 grand a month, you're kind of burnt out doing sales call after sales call after sales call, and you're desperately looking to get out, then I'm like pretty much the guy you call at that moment. And what we do effectively is we help people get off the calls, put sales reps in place, train those sales reps, and then get their business scaled up rapidly. So that's what we do. That's what coaching sales is all about. We primarily focus on really like the spaces that we know well and that we really enjoy working with, which is mostly marketing agencies and high ticket coaches.
So how did you stumble upon this?
Funny question. My rap career didn't quite work out as planned. Right. So that's the real story of it.
Wait, really? I had no idea.
Yeah. So, spit hot fire, I rhyme and I rip, I rip and I rhyme. And, I was at this point where like I did the classic failure that almost every musician does, which is I put all of my money into my product and I had no money for marketing. And so I made a piece of art that I like really was so proud of, and I felt like I had something, and then I released it to crickets, and it was like the saddest, shittiest experience I ever had. And at that point I kind of was like, you know what? Fuck this. Like I need to figure something else out. And I'd already been learning, like I already learned sales. I already learned basically service. And so at that point I was looking for something different. And I was scrolling around Facebook, and then I saw this post that said, hey, I'm looking for a salesperson to help one of my clients grow their agency. And this is like 6 years ago. And I was like, hey, I think I could do that. Like I knew how to sell, and I just was tired of selling crappy products. And I wanted the 4-hour work week type of lifestyle to be able to travel and work remotely and do that sort of thing. And so when I saw that post, I reached out, and they're like, dude, I think you'd be a great fit. And from that point, it was mind blowing. We went from, they were at about 100 grand a month. And I mean, sorry, 100 grand a year, not a month. They were out doing like 10 to 8 grand a month. And I came on the phones, and then within 3 months, we started pacing at about $1 million a year. So we went from $100,000 a year to $1 million a year inside of 3 months. And I'm like, what the hell just happened here? And then in the next like 9 months, we got it to $2 million a year in terms of our run rate. And that was when I was like, holy crap, I think I'm onto something. And so at that point, I was like, okay, I'm going to do this sales agency thing. And I was going around kind of figuring out what I liked. And then I tried to join an agency coaching program because my business was all jacked up. Like I was making other people's businesses grow fast, but mine, I was just stuck at like $5,000 a month. And it was like frustrating the crap out of me. And I tried to join this agency coaching program. And the guy's like trying to sell me. And then I'm like, he's kind of after a while, like, I don't know, man, your business model's jacked up. I don't know if I can actually fix it or help you. And he's like, have you ever considered getting into high ticket coaching and consulting? And I'm like, no, what's this thing? And then he kind of explained to me the premise and like was telling me about this world of selling high ticket coaching and consulting. I was like, that sounds awesome. This is basically what I'm doing, but this sounds like kind of like a whole thing distilled. And then I found a high ticket coaching and consulting program. I kind of joined it as a client. And then within a couple of months of being in the program, they're like, hey, dude, why don't you come build out our sales team? And a lot of the people here know who that is. It's Traffic and Funnels. And so like at the time where they were at, Taylor was taking all the calls. They're at like $80,000 a month. And then within 6 months, we got to $500,000 a month. And it was kind of like, holy crap, I did it again. And at that point, that's kind of when I knew that this was a thing. Like the first time I thought it was a fluke. The second time I realized that it's a thing. And then I was like, I gotta do this more. And I gotta double down on this thing. And so that was pretty much it.
So then you left working with them and started your own thing or what?
Yep. I got the bug, man. I studied entrepreneurship in college. When I was in first grade, the teacher asked me what you want to do. I said, be my own boss. Like just kind of in me. And I, you know, it was awesome growing with them and I learned a lot. But after a given point, it was time for me to kind of do my own thing.
Okay. So you split off and is it just kind of like, hey guys, like you made a Facebook post or sent an email to your email list or what? Like, how did you get those first few people interested?
Yeah. At first it was just kind of like an organic launch style thing. And I did a small Facebook group and I moved people into the Facebook group. And then I did like a series of posts and made an offer and then booked them on calls. And then I closed up a couple people. Which okay. I'm actually, one of the things I'm like most proud of, I got to say, is that my very first client being on our own, this is like a couple years, still works with us today. So that's like something I'm super proud about.
So you were completely solo when you sold this person or your first few people?
Yep.
And what was the offer?
It was a 5K 90 day. I'm going to recruit, train, and hire and manage your sales team for you.
Okay. So pretty much similar to what you guys still offer.
Yep. So exactly.
At that point, you got these first few clients. You're like, okay, this is going well. I like working with these people. I like doing my own thing. What was like your first hire, your first like point of leverage per se?
Good question. So I tried a lot of different things, right? And it didn't work out. And it was really, really frustrating for me. At first, I was kind of in this mentality that I wanted to be like a one-man band. And I had a mentor that was a one-man band. And he's like super profitable, makes shit tons of money just as a one-man band. And I was like, that's awesome the way he's designed his thing. That's what I want. And I thought it was what I wanted. And then I did it. And then I'm like, I don't know if I really want this. And so then I decided that like, what do I really want? This is the question, right? And this is a question that everybody's really got to ask themselves and ask themselves repeatedly because it's going to change. But I was like, what do I really want? And I knew that what I really wanted wasn't to just be like a one-man band that makes $1 million a year. What I really wanted to do was build a portfolio of businesses. And what I really wanted to do was to be able to have effectively multiple businesses under an umbrella group, right? And so I was like, well, if I want to do that, it takes a team. So I have to start learning this team building thing. And I kind of was okay at it. I'd started hiring before I actually was on my own, right? Like the first hires I made, I tried when I had my agency before that, I was doing like I hired VAs. And then I was never good at it, though. It took me a long time. Like, I was talking about this, interestingly, with my wife, Adriana. And the first person I hired, I think, was somewhere around 2015. And I feel like I haven't gotten, like, actually good at it until this year. Like, late last year, or, like, this year, I now feel like I'm, like, really fucking good at it. And there's still more to learn, don't get me wrong, but it took me like 4 or 5 years to be able to feel like really proud of the way that I lead and build teams.
So let's talk about that for a second then. What's the journey? What was the journey to become, to go from like, I've never really run a team before, I've never been good at it, to you know what to look for in people? Because like for me, I started off the same way. I was like, I want to be a one-man team. I want to build a completely automated webinar that does millions of dollars. I don't talk to anyone. No one talks to me. No support, no calls, automate everything. Never, don't even have a VA, just eliminate everything. And then I was like, damn, that kind of sucks. It, like, I'm kind of on the same page as you. I was like, yeah, this kind of sucks.
And by the way, if you find a business where you don't have to talk with clients and you don't have to talk with prospects and you don't have to talk with team members and you don't have to talk to anybody, let me know, because I'd be curious. I've never found one.
Dude, the only thing
I've looked for it for a while. I've never seen it.
Like people that do like YouTube and they're just like blown up YouTube and only have to make videos and that's it.
You still have to comment. You still have to do that stuff, right? Or, and if you're not going to be the one to comment, you got to have a VA that does the stuff for you. It's still going to be done.
Like for me, it was like, I remember I hired my first, I mean, I had like the tax business before and like that was just impossible to run without help. But it was just very different than like hiring online. So I remember like my experience was like, okay, I need some help. I got a VA. VA was terrible, or really I was probably just terrible at like
leading. It was you. VA. Yeah, it was you.
And then, so I fired him and then I was like, okay, let me try to just be solo again. And then I was like, okay, let me just try to use technology to solve this problem. Cause I just hated hiring. And then I started to just see how other people did things. And then I was like, okay, maybe if I try that, it wouldn't be so bad. So I did that. And then it was like me and one person running the ship for a while. And then we got a second person and I'm like, okay, this is good. Like I'm doing less, everything's more efficient. And then we got salespeople and started working with you guys and stuff. So what was that journey like for you?
I think you really hit it and it's like, it's very similar for me. And for the listener who's tuning into this, I want to speak directly to you right now, which is that, you know, what JR mentioned is that he went through this process where he hired a VA and it didn't work out. And then he like didn't hire someone again for a long time because he thought that VA sucked and or that he like just wanted to do it on his own. And that's the belief. You're naturally going to come up to that belief when a hire doesn't work out. Because usually when you're first hiring, you have this crazy idea that everybody should be magically working immediately and that they should make you way more money and you should be far more productive because you've hired someone. But like, you don't have necessarily the skill set yet to delegate. You don't have the systems or the documentation to clearly delegate. And also, like, you just haven't gone through the motions to really understand how to do it properly. And you have to take the mindset that, hey, this first hire probably isn't going to work out. I'm going to do whatever I can to make sure it does. But if it doesn't work out, I'm just going to assume it's not going to. Then I'm going to go hire another person again. And I'm going to learn from all those mistakes and try to incorporate it into the second hire. Or you just pay someone like JR who actually makes sure that they work out the first time for you, right? Which is another really smart idea. Probably a better idea than being determined to follow through even though you fail. And I did the same thing, right? So for me, it was like, hey, I hired this person. I was kind of a disorganized mess, right? Like I tend to be more that like visionary type than the integrator type. I don't necessarily believe in like hard and fast lines and boxing things into categories, but like I have a leaning that way, let's say. And I tend to be better at starting things than finishing things, right? And so my great idea was that my first hire is going to be a project manager and the project manager is going to basically make sure that everything gets done and organize things. And I had seen what agile scrum had done in teams before. So I was like, I need someone who knows how to run an agile scrum process and have a project manager to move all the things along. And they completely failed. And it was by no fault of their own. They were actually good. I just didn't have the skill sets to do it. I didn't understand what they were doing. I didn't like have the commitment to understand what they were doing and adapt my behaviors fast enough. And so they completely failed, but it was 100% my fault. And then I was like, I did the thing, right? I did the, oh, I'm just going to go back to doing my own thing then. And I did that for a while. And I would delegate like little odd things here and there on Fiverr because that was kind of easy because they're very specified tasks.
Yeah.
And then gradually I got to the point where I was doing the sales thing and I was like, holy crap, I'm taking too many calls. I gotta get some help because like I got all these calls and I got to follow up with people and I got to confirm appointments and I got to do all these little activities on a day-to-day basis. So then I hired an assistant and at first I hired an assistant to try and organize my personal life. Like I hired a personal assistant, right? Which my personal life, like I don't think I was important enough to deserve a personal assistant at that point, right? Like to order my food and arrange my travel and stuff like that. But like, I just don't think that was the right place for me to be delegating because that was those are cost centers anyway. Mm-hmm. Whereas like then what I did was the next time, so that one failed, of course, I did Zirtual at that point too. You got to go from like service to service and then you blame the service. I think that's part of the process. So Zirtual sucks. It's got to be Zirtual. And then I found this thing called Task Bullet and they gave me VAs and that worked all right, but they weren't that great. Their project management system was too rigid for me. And then I just hired a VA, someone that I knew in my personal network. And then she rocked it and she was smart and could figure things out and needed just a little bit of direction and she would rock it. And she was great. And then eventually like some team, like the people that I was working with ended up stealing her because they could afford to pay her more money than I could. That was a sad day. But the thing that was like the first time I was like, it worked. And I think that the reason it worked, like if I look at it and I analyze it and I unpack it, it's because she was revenue generating, right? She was buying me time doing work that would have been something that somebody would have paid for. And so she was buying me the low level tasks to get me to the higher level tasks. And so then I could spend my time really concentrating on the stuff where the big money was made.
Yeah. So yesterday I was doing jujitsu and I got like kicked in the face while I was getting armbarred and I have a black eye now. And I didn't notice how bad it actually got until literally right now seeing in myself in the camera. And so I've had other podcasts today and no one's mentioned a thing. So if anyone is watching the recording afterwards and you realize I have a black eye, that's the story.
I thought it was a cinematic shadow.
my hiring black eye was very similar. Like I remember, so first one didn't work out. Second one was through a service where it was kind of weird. Like you would just put in tasks and then the VAs would do the tasks, but it was always like a different person. Like
that's what I was describing. That thing.
And then they bill you like for hours. And then sometimes I'd be like, really, does it really take like 5 hours to like make this logo or whatever? That was super simple. After a while I just kind of gave up on that. And the problem was what you said, like I would just give up and I wouldn't keep trying. Like I wouldn't be like, oh, that's hard. I'd be like, I'd give up and revert back to what I was doing before. And then I realized that my mental roadblock was like, well, I don't know how much work I have to give a VA. So what do I do if I, you know, bring them on for like 30 hours a week and I only have 15 hours worth of work. And that was like the weird place I was stuck at one point. And then what I came up with to get out of that was like, one of my buddies actually told me, he's like, oh, I just have fallback tasks. Like when they're not doing stuff I'm telling them to do, they're just doing, you know, this like outreach and stuff like that. So what we train VAs for is like what we call revenue generating tasks first. So even if you have a VA, you want them to work 20 hours a week or 30 hours a week, but you don't know if you have that much work consistently, I'd say just have them do outreach. Like have them email people that you'd want to connect with or that would be important for you, or just send emails or do something that they can just resort to over and over and over again to keep them busy while you build out your systems and your processes. Now, like my VAs log in and they give me like a list of like all the things that they're going to get done for that day. And then we have a daily huddle too. Thanks to you, which I definitely want to talk about. Daily huddle, complete game changers. We haven't missed a single one since I went to your event. 10:15 every morning, Monday through Friday. And then, so now they like log in, they tell me what they're going to be working on. And then I'll give them feedback on the daily huddle. And then I say, hey, if you finish with that stuff, you guys know what to do. Like, just hit the outreach or whatever. So what has been like, as far as like hiring, let's transition over to like talking about salespeople, because that's something that people struggle with. What do you think has been the biggest leverage points in sales itself, and then in hiring salespeople that you see is the biggest opportunity for people to make a change?
Yeah. So I want to bridge kind of where we were to where we're about to go, because I think that there's an idea that is like really foundational. And once you grasp this big idea, and I'm talking to you, the listener, so once you grasp this, then the whole process becomes a lot easier. So something that you pointed out that was also true in my experience, and I want to highlight this for you guys, is that the thing that made it start to work was when you started to delegate revenue generating tasks, right? And I think that the thing that almost everyone does naturally the first time that they delegate is they try to delegate these things that they think are waste of time tasks, or that are like, mm-hmm. they're kind of negative dollar tasks or $0 tasks, like ordering my groceries or
dude, my like that. VA's first week, it was like, hey, schedule someone to come detail my car. Find me a place to go, like do this appointment, call this place and schedule this. Like, it was all just personal stuff like that.
And it sounds like a great idea, but it's actually a terrible idea, because you're accelerating the rate at which you're spending money, right? Because all those things, you got to spend money to get your car detailed. You got to spend money to get your dry cleaning. You got to spend money to go to that appointment. So when you make more efficient spending money, it really starts to like dig you in this trench that's harder, when really like at first, the thing that needs to be made more efficient and you need to kind of get the arbitrage in is where it's a dollar per hour that you're generating that money. So for you, like it was prospecting and things like that. And I think that's like a great starting point for most VAs, is like if your VAs are booking you appointments or they're going out and doing outreach, cold outreach, that's stuff that you would do anyway. And when you're doing it, you're making money. It's work. It's not work, right? So you're scaling your work time. And so the concept that we apply inside of our business, and it's just sort of a personal mental model, I call it time scaling. So what I'm looking for is dollar per hour tasks. And usually I'm going to 80-20 analysis my time. I'm going to track my time. I'm going to 80-20 my time. And then I'm going to figure out what are the activities that I do that are really, really small time spent that are maximum money generated. And what are the things that I'm doing that are most time spent and minimum money generated? But all of them are money generating. This is the key, right? Like if it's personal stuff, this doesn't count. It doesn't fit into the time scaling, right? So if it's money generating, then I try and figure out the things that I'm doing most time, minimum money, and then get that to someone else, right? And then the curve shifts upward. And the curve shifting upwards along the path, right? So your bottom dollar per hour in the beginning is $3 to $5 per hour. Then it moves up, and your lowest dollar per hour is say $10 per hour. Then your lowest dollar per hour, once you get those things off your plate, gets to 20, 25. Then it moves up to $50 an hour. Then you're up to $100 an hour, right? And so your goal is to constantly be clearing out the lowest dollar per hour activities on your curve, right?
Yeah. Now, like I'm at the point where I wouldn't dare tell my VA to like, hey, go get me a car detailed, because I'm like, she's talking to clients and stuff all day. Like there's that, I'd be losing money basically by paying her to go out and do stuff like that rather than, you know, talk to clients and do revenue generating activities. So now I realize how silly it was to like the first day my VA was on, I was like, hey, can you get my car detailed or whatever? Just because I was like, I wanted to feel like I was this cool entrepreneur that was delegating tasks and all this shit. So, I mean, it was good to kind of get me like the buzz of like, okay, other people can do things for me. So from there, how do you transition to then, people doing actual sales for you?
Yeah. So this is an important concept to note. So if we apply time scaling as a model, the whole basic principle is I want to get my lowest dollar per hour off my plate first, right? So if you look in any organization, salespeople get paid the most, right? Sometimes salespeople will make even more than the CEO, sometimes salespeople will make as much as executives. So what I try and explain to most of our clients is that sales should be the absolute last thing you delegate, right? I normally want you to delegate your fulfillment first, right? So if you think about customer service people, how much do they make? A customer service person on average makes like 30, 40 grand a year, right? So get customer service out. Like coaches, your coaches are going to make 50, 60 grand a year. Get them out first. Like then you move into your marketing. Marketing's usually going to make a little bit less than sales, but a little bit more than some of your fulfillment people. So then start to delegate your marketing and then move to sales last. And like sales should be the last thing you give up in sort of an employee role before you transition fully into a CEO or type of like executive manager role. And the reason is because it's your highest dollar priority activity. So until sales becomes your lowest dollar priority activity, don't give it up. But then once you're there, now it's time to give it up, right? And so some of the stuff that we teach about it, to answer your question, I just wanted to make sure that they had the pre-frame and they understood it in advance, because most people come to us and they think, I need to get sales off my plate because I don't like sales. It's like, I don't really care what you like. You decided to be a business owner, so you need to do something that you don't like in order to get a result. And then so as it starts to make sense. Though,
before you go into that, one thing that came up for me, so I haven't delegated fulfillment yet completely. I've part of it, like VA does, assistant does onboarding and stuff like that. But I do like an onboarding call and I do my two group weekly coaching calls. Does it still make sense to get that off your plate first when it takes so much less time? And I feel like that it's so nuanced, like coaching people and stuff like that. And it takes on for me, like let's say we onboard seven new clients in a week, that's 7 hours plus the 2 hours that I'd already do. But to sell those clients, that'd be, let's say 35 hours, right, of taking calls. So does it make sense to still delegate sales when it takes up so much more time than doing the fulfillment, in at least in my scenario?
Yeah. And that's a really good question. It has a lot to do with how much leverage you have in the coaching process, right? So in a typical agency model, they're going to want to delegate the fulfillment stuff first. Where you're at, like it's only a couple hours a week and it makes sense to hang on to for a little bit and then eventually let go of it. If sales is a bigger part of time, then usually what's going to happen is, yes, it's going to be revenue generating, but like you're supporting all the revenue and the concentration, because a lot of it's about the concentration. So if you're serving however many clients you're serving at once, that time has more dollars per hour concentrated in it because of the way you've created the distribution model, right? So it's a little bit of a different game. And there's exceptions to every rule. Like don't get me wrong, there's exceptions to every rule. This is normally though the methodology that like I apply, and it makes the most sense, is try and get the low dollar per hour stuff cleared out as quickly as possible so you can keep moving up the ranks. And like it's weird, if you do this, your problem as a business owner is going to be that you got to be a person that loves to adapt and loves to become a different person, because every other week almost, or every other month at the longest sometimes, you're literally completely changing your workday. And you go from doing one thing to now doing something completely different. And it's weird. It's disorienting in some ways. And you got to embrace that. And then you got to embrace the desire to kind of keep learning the new skill so you can keep advancing to that next phase and spending the time there. But back to the salespeople. So this is partly, like if we were to trace my journey of delegating, there was this phase where I thought, okay, I'm going to McDonald's-ize my business. Right? I think everybody's get this idea at one point. And I'm like, yeah, I'm going to make everything this like rigid SOP that even a monkey could follow it type of thing, right? And so I was like, I'm going to McDonald's-ize my business. This is going to be the greatest thing ever. I'm going to document everything. I'm going to have SOPs for everything. And so I went to go do that. And then I hired a bunch of VAs. And then I hired pretty much like low dollar per hour VAs. And I didn't fully understand the levels of delegation. And so they all kept routing back to me with questions. And now I was having to decide everything for everybody, which was almost its own little hell. Like, because they're doing things and then they get stuck and they can't figure things out. Mm-hmm. So they come back to me because they couldn't figure it out. And I was like, oh my God, this is so frustrating. And there was a mentor who once told me, he's like, well, sounds like you got a whole lot more hands, but not a lot more brains. Right. And I was like, dang, that hit, that makes perfect sense. And they kept coming back to me, but they were just basically like hands, and everything had to route back through my brain, which was like exhausting and frustrating. And like, I kind of lost it at a point. And so I was like, I went back to, again, oh, I'm just going to do everything myself. This is it. And then finally there was this one day I was like literally on the ground in my apartment, like begging my wife to help me. Like I was just, it was so overwhelmed and burnt out to the max. And I couldn't keep up. I always felt like I was drowning. Like it was like the fastest I could run, it would still keep piling on faster than I could get it done. And at that point, I mean, I was pretty good at being high leverage. Like I was doing 30, 40 grand a month, just a single dude by myself, building the business, building the product, doing recruitment and fulfillment and training and sales and everything, but it just got too much. And then at that point I hired our first team member who's actually still on our team today. And he was like a godsend to me, and he's been amazing. His name's Moose. A lot of you guys may have talked with Moose, but he was the more brains, and like I was able to train him. He was able to get it quickly, and then he could start to think for himself. And it was more a process of coaching him on how to think through problems instead of me thinking through them for him. And it was like, that was like, I don't know, it was this major shift where I felt like so much more leverage, was shifting from just trying to get more hands to more brains. But then there's a balance, right? And so now, like, I'd like to revisit this later in our conversation, because there's a new epiphany that I've had after that, but I'll kind of leave it there.
Yeah, I had one of my VAs is with me, and I've seen her transition from a hand to a brain. And it's been really, really interesting. And part of me feels like maybe I just got lucky because I just got someone that was able to do that. But part of me is like, well, I remember her early on, like maybe 3 months in, saying something like, I would ask her like once a week, I'd be like, hey, what do you think we can do to improve? And what do you think like I could do to like make you happier and stuff? And one time, and I was like, what do you think we're doing well? And she's like, well, I think we're doing well with our clients. I think we can continue to do that and a couple different things. But she said, I really appreciate how much you trust me and make me feel comfortable with making mistakes. And it was kind of like an epiphany, and it was a week where I had like been on this like cruise ship, and she was like just running shit while I was on this cruise ship. But it was like a marketing event. So I was still like very much plugged in. But I remember that was kind of like an epiphany of like, okay, there's, if it's the right person and you trust them and give them opportunity to make mistakes, they will transition into someone that can make decisions. She built out, so we train VAs for agency owners. She built out the entire training program, like the rubric, what we're going to train at what time. She built an oral assessment, a written assessment. I had like zero to do with that. I just kind of saw it, and she didn't even really ask me. She was just like, hey, we need this, and let me roll out and get this done. And then we had another one that was not so much like that. And then we got another one that was really just a hand, like not even two hands, just like one. So I've seen like the full spectrum, and it's really interesting to kind of observe. So have you noticed anything similar when it comes to like trusting people, or cause that was a big thing for me, is like, I just never felt like, half the time I'd be spending my day just wondering if people are actually working or not.
Yeah. So, it's funny, because that is the epiphany, right? That was the question that you're asking is the exact same epiphany that I had, which was at first I was hiring a lot of hands and no brains. And then I was like, oh my gosh, hands are the problem. I need brains. And I hired a brain, and it was the best thing ever. So then suddenly my brain was like, the solution is just to hire a bunch more brains. And that was not the solution, actually. That was a mistake that I thought was the solution. It's a balance, right? You need hands and you need brains, right? Hands support your brains, and then the hands can develop into brains if you get really good at delegating and you get good at ascending the levels of trust. And so typically if you're hiring someone at the hands level, it's going to be a very clear, you do this at this specific time, and here's exactly how I want you to do it, and you're going to copy and paste this script, and you're going to be reliable and do that, right? Then what you suggested was, you know, you're inviting them to improve the process. You're inviting them to provide feedback. You're inviting them to find ways to make things more efficient. And then they gradually will prove like that they're really, really good at it for you. And then they do become a brain. And so like we have one of our team members who's our operations assistant, and she's pretty much like a killer project manager. We love her. She's been working with us for a couple years. And she started out as a hand, and then she started improving the process and making things more efficient. And she took a process that took us 20 hours and turned it into a process that took us 5 hours. And like, she started really just showing that she was really good at it. And so we started giving her more and more trust and more authority. And now she's really good. She will recruit, train people for us. She'll build out things entirely from scratch for us. And like, we trust her at that level, but it's because she started out as a hand and we were able to ascend the trust. And so, it's a balance, right? You're going to find that you want brains when you need brains, and you're going to need hands when you need hands. And then it's being able to figure out who's who and then know your people well enough. And then your goal also is to develop every like hand into a brain if you can, and then develop every brain into just basically like a meta brain, which is like your executive level type of person, right? And so the more you can take these people who have like the cognitive critical reasoning abilities and can solve problems for you, and you develop their skill sets and refine their skill sets, eventually they could become the CEO. And like, so one of the things, we have a year-long program where people work with us called Successful CEOs. And people will oftentimes work with us for longer than a year just because of the nature of the journey and what you're learning inside of the container. And the thing we teach most of our people is that I want to teach you how to become a CEO, not so that you can be a CEO. I want you to become the chairman, right? And the chairman's the true investor in the business. The CEO reports to the chairman. And when you're at chairman level, you can run multiple businesses. You can operate multiple businesses. And like, you think about Tony Robbins, right? Robbins Research International. He's the chairman of the company. He's not the CEO of the company. And so we glamorize oftentimes the CEO, which being a CEO is something that's actually amazing. And when you develop the skill set, it's really empowering. But then there's a level where the CEO still has a boss, and that's the chairman. So how do you get yourself to the level of chairman? You know, and that's oftentimes how we want to challenge people to think.
What would you say is like one of the simplest things that you've done in your organization that's created the biggest impact or the most amount of leverage? Like, for an example of that for us is daily huddles, like such a simple thing people talk about. I've heard it mentioned 5+ times at different events and stuff. And my attitude towards it was always like, fuck that. The second we started doing that, we like dramatic increase in happiness, communication. I just feel better about everything. I look forward to our daily huddles. And originally I was like, why would I do a 15-minute meeting every day? That feels like I'm creating like a ball and chain rather than, you know, a business. But that's just been a super, super game changer for me. That was worth going to your event, like just that little tidbit. So what other things do you have like that? Because I'm all about, the more I like learn, the more I realize, like, even if Jeff Bezos worked, you know, 3 hours a day, he'd probably still make more money than me, because he has all the leverage points and the leverage connections and the hacks and stuff. So what are some more things like daily huddles that you've seen just have massive impacts on the organizations of you and all your clients? Because I know you see a lot of data as well.
It's a good question. I mean, there's a lot of little things. The daily huddle is probably one of the better things that we've implemented as well. That's why I'm so like gung-ho about it, is because just the pace of communication accelerates, your ability to deliver and ship things accelerates, and also your ability to stop recurring problems accelerates. So that's been a big one. But I mean, if anything, if I had to boil it down to one thing, I think it would be meta learning, right? So if you learn how to learn, that's the greatest leverage point you can ever have, because you can accelerate the development of everything. And so like some things in meta learning, like I've learned how to read books. Like, I was a reader, don't get me wrong, I was a good reader, My dad has a funny story about, like, I couldn't read for crap when I was little. And like they actually thought I was like a little slow kid for a while. And then I failed kindergarten because I couldn't read. And one day I came back from my second kindergarten and I'm like, hey, Dad, I read 7 books today. He's like, what? I'm like, yeah, I'm a reader now. And he's like, this kid's lying. I'm like, no, I read the books. Everyone heard me. I did it out loud. And then he's like, no, you got to show me. And so I read the books with him and he always finds that funny. But the I learned how to read a book, right? And like the way most people read books is completely wrong. They don't, or there's no real wrong way, but they don't understand. Most people will open a book and then they read it from start to finish and they feel guilty if they don't finish, right? And they think that they have to read it in sequence. The real secret to reading a book is you start with the table of contents, then you go to the back of the book. And then from there, you scan the things that make the most sense or are most relevant for you. And then from there, you'll decide if it's worth reading more or not. And maybe you get your information that you need in just that one little blip. Yeah. Or maybe you go back through the rest of it and you decide this book's worth studying. But when you start to do that, dude, like I've read 75 plus books this year and we're not even through April.
So interesting that you say that because I did that the other day for the first time. There's this book called Unshakable by Tony Robbins. And it's about like how to manage your finances and how people get rich and what the most successful people do with money. He spends like an hour and a half just talking to you about fees and why fees will kill your wealth. That's something that I could literally, like I literally skimmed through it. He said, okay, here's the kinds of funds and companies to avoid. And here's the kind you should work with. And he took an hour and a half basically on the audiobook version just to get to that point. So I skimmed through that. And a lot of times I'll buy the audio and the physical copy because the audio lets me, like the physical copy lets me skim through and then see what's more important for the audio. But then he gets to the whole point where he actually gives you the strategy. And that's maybe like an hour and a half. So really this, like, I don't know, 12-hour book is the main points are in the beginning where he's basically telling you like, hey, you're fucked unless you read this book, which is like an hour and a half of him telling you, hey, you're fucked. And then there's an hour and a half of him telling you about fees. And then he actually has the strategy. So really I could have went through and just read the strategy. And then he has what he calls the core four. And the core four is basically the strategy. So all that in, 30, 40 pages versus having to read this entire book. Because most of the time when you ask somebody, hey, what's that book about? They're going to give you the main point from the book. They're not going to sit down and give you like what they read on every single page or every single chapter. It's going to be like their biggest takeaways. So it's interesting that you say that because that's a big leverage move right there. And I noticed like you quote books a lot, like you had me pick up Principles by Ray Dalio. I'm trying to get Tribe of Mentors when it comes out on audio as well. But that's a very, very interesting point. Using books as a tool to get like what you need or like what they call just-in-time learning, get the value that you need and then like move on with it or decide that you should, study this a little bit better.
Yep. And the magic of a book, right? Like, so at the end of the book, everybody puts their summary argument, which is the sum of all the arguments together in the most cohesive format. So if you just skip straight to the end, you could find the just basic general outline of it. And then you could say, oh, I don't really understand that. Or, oh, that actually part is most relevant to me right now. And then you jump right to what you actually need and you get the information you need and then you move on. Or you decide, okay, this is worth digging deeper. Let me go dig deeper. The thing about a book, what's really fascinating about a book is that it's like, there's a couple things. You get to think someone else's thoughts. That alone is magical. Like you're thinking someone else's thoughts and someone who's probably way smarter than you in a specific domain and getting results that you want to get in that domain, right? So the fact that you can just like literally sync your brainwaves with their brainwaves is a miracle. It's like literally magic if you think about it in that context. And then the second component of reading a book is that when someone's writing a book, they're putting their best foot forward, right? They're really laying out the things that they believe to be most important. And they're laying out like their magnum opus of the work that they're trying to present to you. So if you read the person's book, you are pretty much getting the bulk of like what you need to know from that person. And then the little thing that like will kind of complement that, there's two little tricks that I'll tell you in meta learning that these are like magical. One is look inside the book on Amazon. So, and I do this anytime I'm selling a new offer, I'll study this stuff because it's magical, dude. You find the book that the market's going to read. You look at the table of contents. You understand basically all the objections or all the problems or all the beliefs that people have or everything that they need to understand. And you look at that. And then what you do is you go, customers also bought. And you look at all the books that the customers also bought on the same subject. And you look inside and you go straight to the table of contents. And you're looking for what are the patterns. And then the minute you pick out the patterns, that's when you really can start to say, ah, I see like the core foundational principles of this topic that I need to understand. And then you start to be able to pick those off. And so that is one of my like go-to tricks is I'll use look inside the book and customers also bought to be able to acquire information to understand subject matter really fast. So like an example is we bought health insurance this year. You know, before I had health insurance, but it's always like, I don't know what I'm getting when I got it. And it's just like a thing I just got. Because, you know, when you're in your mid-20s, you think like I'm invincible and I'm never going to die anyway. So what's the matter? And now when we have a baby on the way. So everything changes when a baby comes. And we had to get insurance. You know, we have to deal with hospitals. We have to deal with the pregnancy. We have to deal with everything. Like there's stuff happens during pregnancy. So I want to make sure we're protected. So I read 9 books in a week about insurance, and I could tell you more about insurance than an insurance agent could tell you about insurance. I literally would talk to the insurance agents, and they would have less concepts or idea of what I'm talking about because they don't even understand the product that they're selling. And it takes less than a week and just skimming a bunch of books really fast. So if you learn how to speed read, you learn how to do this stuff, you can become a subject matter expert almost in anything like that. So meta learning is probably the biggest key to being able to rapidly acquire skills. And then the other little secret to reading books is everyone who writes a book has appeared on podcasts. So what do you do?
Yeah.
You go listen to the podcast in addition to the book, and you can find all their ideas anyway, because they typically are going to present the most interesting ideas that they have in their book on the podcast. And so you can like really complement your learning to where it anchors in deep. If you just Google the author's name podcast and you use these kind of like principles, you can skip the line and just go straight to the front with this. So that's probably is tip. Like, yeah, that's probably like the biggest leveraged point
I'm experienced. Just thinking like, so I'm really into like biohacking and health and stuff like that. And my girlfriend is too. And we heard this person on a podcast talking about like holistic dental care and like this regimen to like heal cavities and like fix your teeth. And I was bleeding from my gums like every time I brushed my teeth. And I'm like, what the fuck? Like, I don't even have any cavities or whatever. So we hear this chick on the podcast, go buy her book, skip everything in the book, just get straight down to the regimen because we heard like, you know, what's wrong with the dental industry and like all the philosophies of on the podcast, went to the book, got the remedy. And then we just bought all the shit and started to do it. Within a week, my gums stopped bleeding and I didn't have to sit down and read a whole book. So that makes total sense. And there's another case where there's this book on, my girlfriend was also looking into like how birth control really fucks up your hormones as a woman. And the girl, now that I think about it, has been on every health podcast that I've seen, like Dave Asprey's show, The Model Health Show, et cetera. And then basically on the podcast, it's her, the first half of the book, essentially her saying why birth control started, why it's all fucked up, why it messes up your hormones. And then they're like, oh, but you got to get my book to get the full, you know, treatment. So you listen to the podcast and then you just buy the book, skip all the way to the treatment part and you have the gist. And like, do you really need to know all the history behind birth control and everything that goes into it and the regulations behind it and stuff? Like, not really. You just need to be able to get the outcome. So that's super, super smart. We've kind of been doing that just in reverse. Like usually we'll find somebody on a podcast, then get the book. But now I'm definitely going to try getting the book, listening to the podcast, and then just skipping to the book and finding out the specific things that I want. Because that's one thing, like I'll get disinterested in a book because I'm a third of the way in. And they just haven't gotten to the point yet, to the thing that I actually want to learn. And then I'll just kind of forget or pick up another book or whatever.
Yep. And you only need one idea for a book to be worth it, right? So that's why table of contents and then skip to the end. Those are like the key secrets. And then you just go skim any chapter that jumps out at you.
Yeah. I'm thinking of so many books now that I didn't need to read. Like there's this book called I Will Teach You to Be Rich, all about how to invest your money and stuff like that by Ramit Sethi. Same thing. Beginning, he's talking about why everyone's fucked. Essentially, he tells you like what mutual funds to invest in and how to buy them. And that's literally like, I read this entire book, literally just waiting for like those three lines when I should have just skipped to that section. Cause that's pretty much the strategy I've been following since I read that book. So, that's super, super smart. I mean, I have a bookshelf full of shit back here that I haven't been through probably even like, I've probably been through like half of those books at this point. So this will highly accelerate my learning. So what do you think is something that we have a little bit of time left? What do you think are the biggest leverage points in sales? And what are the most common like three things that you see people do wrong?
Those are two different questions, right? So the biggest leverage point though
I'm is the king to understand of asking two questions at once.
The biggest leverage point is to understand what we call the emotional journey of the sale, right? And so if you study like the hero's journey, you know, there's like this meta story that's been told for every story ever, and Harry Potter and Luke Skywalker are actually the same guy. And it's like, he's so Spider-Man, and then every theme park basically makes all their money off of this one story that keeps being repeated. Okay, so sales is not any different. Every sales presentation is the same story, and it's just you're changing characters and settings, right? So your character being your problem or outcome and the person who's helping you solve it. But the general gist of the sales process is the same. And there's an emotional journey. And if you can architect the emotional journey repeatedly, you can sell consistently. You don't need to be a genius. You don't need to be talkative. You don't need to be persuasive. You don't need to be anything. You just need to design this journey and then allow someone to go on it. And then if they're allowed to go on it, it's really like we all love it. It's the same way that we all love Spider-Man and Harry Potter and everything. We all love to buy stuff. And so when someone allows you to buy something, it's a really amazing experience. Like the highest high is the moment that you make a purchase. Like I just bought something Sunday and I was sitting there like at the cart like, oh my God. And then I bought it and I was like, yeah, I did that. Like I did like a little fist pump to myself. Like, yeah, I'm so pumped. And like, it's because buying is fun. We love buying. So once you realize that and you design the journey to allow someone to buy, that's the highest leverage point. And so what that journey is, we call it the three-act play. And so we have something we call the Hollywood sales method that we teach. And like, this isn't something revelatory, but I just try to distill everything to its most simple concept to allow someone to learn how to sell and get traction fast. And basically the three-act play is, first, you have to discover the desire, right? So why are they on the phone? What do they want? What, and like you think that you understand what they want when they tell you their surface level motivation, but we got to get to the root cause motivation, right? And so once we discover the desire, and it could be something that people aspire towards or they want to run away from. And so we discover the desire. Then from there, you got to build the belief. So they have to believe that your product has exactly what they need in order to quench that desire, in order to give them what they want. And then from that point, people can have the desire, know that the thing has exactly what they want, but they still have an emotional resistance, right? So the thing that I bought this past week, I've been wanting for a long time. I've used it before and I know it gives me exactly what I want. But I just hadn't bought it because there was always some sort of reason or story or justification. And like there's an emotional resistance. So I needed permission to be able to purchase it. Right. And so overcoming the resistance is about how you then handle their emotions, label their emotions, and then effectively make sure that they retain control and ownership of their decision, and you like are helping them give themselves permission. You're not giving them permission, you're helping them give themselves permission to purchase it from you. And if you do those three things in that sequence, you're going to start getting sales, and it's going to be consistent and easy.
So would you apply that to anything from high ticket sales to, let's say, somebody who sells $10,000 bikes in a bike shop. And because usually, and the reason I bring this up is because I just got my bike fixed because of the whole coronavirus and stuff, you know, more outdoorsy exercise. So I walk in and they're like, oh, what can I help you with? And I'm just like, oh, you know, typical answer, just looking. And they're like, okay, cool. We'll see you later. Do you think that a better approach would be like, oh, cool. So like, what do you plan to do with your bike? And what's your goal with having a bike? Are you just looking to get in shape or just be able to see cool trails or stuff like that? And then take them through, find out like my real desire for wanting to ride the bike. And then where would you take the conversation from there if you would go down this rabbit hole?
Yeah. I mean, a big thing is like, are you selling to the right person? Right. And so you have to ask yourself, were you the right person in that moment? Did you actually want something?
I actually just wanted to fix my bike.
Okay. So if they start trying to sell you, then they're not going to, like, you're not the right person to sell to. Right. Sales is about like channeling
accessories or whatever.
Yeah. But sales is about taking a desire that's pre-existing and channeling it into a product. It's not about building desire out of nowhere. Right. And so like, that's why people hate salespeople, because they don't want something and the person tries to make them want the thing. Mm-hmm. Right. And so like, yeah, there's psychological games that you can use to kind of make people want stuff at times, but it's not necessarily the most effective strategy. The most effective strategy is just to have conversations with people who want stuff. And, you had no desire to purchase a bike. So if they go in and they start trying to sell you a bike, the only thing that they're going to do is they're going to kill any form of goodwill that you have to the business, and you'll probably never want to re-enter their establishment. So in the short term, it seems like they lost a sale, but in the long term, they lost a customer, and it's more expensive to lose a customer than it is to lose a sale. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So some people want to play the short game. Some people want to play the long game. It's just kind of like, what are you in it for is a big question to ask. And like another fundamental process of selling is you got to sell to the right people. And then once you find the right people, you have to make them the right offer. And then you have to also use the right language to describe how they're describing it. And if you can do those three things, then it's selling is easy. But anyone is going to get frustrated if they're making the wrong offer to the right person, or they're making the right offer to the wrong person. And like, in fact, making the right offer to the wrong person is one of the like things that we see cause salespeople go into slumps more than anything else.
Okay. So in my bike scenario, you think a better approach would be like, so if somebody comes into your bike shop and says, oh, I'm just looking, what would you rebut that with?
See, the thing is, you're asking about a rebuttal. I don't need it. Like, I'm trying to overcome. And if they're saying, I'm just looking, they're saying, please stay away from me. Right? So the minute I start coming in, it's like, yeah, I can do it. I can do like little Jedi mind tricks to get them there. But really, I want to just help them have whatever they want. Right? So it's just basically like, let me know what specific questions you might have. Because usually a question is where interest starts. And so the minute they have a question, then you could say something. Or the other thing you could do is just be like, oh, have you seen this thing? And like talk to them about current events and get them loosened up to right. Then maybe they ask you the question. But those are kind of like the main things. But people want to try and make people buy stuff, which if you're doing that, look, it's possible. It's possible. But you don't create lifelong customers. You create transactions. And sometimes a transaction at the expense of creating a lifelong customer is actually more expensive.
So what would you say is, so in a sale, what percentage of it is marketing versus being a good salesperson?
It's a combination, right? So like, a lot of people who think they're good salespeople, they're just on good offers with good marketing, right? Marketing predicates sales, so typically it's more important because it's before the sale occurs, right? I think the best way to know if someone's good at selling or not is if they can take someone who's a maybe and turn them into a yes, right? There's plenty of people who could take a yes and make sure it's a yes at the end of the conversation. But being a real salesperson is you take someone who's like, I don't know, I'm kind of like, I'm interested, but and they have like some sort of reluctance. And to take a maybe and turn them into a yes, to me, that's like, okay, now we got a real salesperson here.
Cool, man. Well, we're just at about our time limit. So let everybody know where they can get some coaching sales and where they can find out more about you.
Yeah, just check us out. It's coachingsales.com. That's going to be the best place to find us. If you go to coachingsales.com/playbook, we also have like basically an exact step-by-step playbook that we've drawn out as to how to delegate your sales calls, when to know if you're ready, kind of who to look for, how to execute it properly. So if you want to, and you're kind of in that spot where you got consistent appointments and you're ready to get off of sales calls, I would just go to coachingsales.com/playbook, and that's going to be the best bet.
Yeah. And I'm a customer, super happy, one of the best coaching programs I've ever been in. And it's not just a coaching program. Like, you will find people, salespeople, you'll help people run their sales programs. It's a lot of stuff that you guys do.
Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you so much.
Hey, if you enjoyed this podcast, and I'd be forever grateful if you left us a 5-star review on the app you're listening on so we can help more people. And if you want more content like this, then click that subscribe button now. And until next time, my friends, stay leveraged.